Updates tuned to yesterday with an hour of collection curios. I'm your host, Mark Lefonier. The Old Time Radio Collection at WRVO Public Media, known as the Ellen Robinson Memorial Library, contains tens of thousands of broadcasts on reel-to-reel tape, and there's a vast archive of the big-name shows from radio's golden age, but among the shelves are series with very few surviving episodes, one-off programs, underheard tapes, and long considered to be rare broadcasts. In this hour, we'll get the reel spinning with programs not yet heard on our show, and at the very least, on the air in a very long time. Later in the hour, imagine history on Stroke of Fate from 1953, but first it's a broadcast of Treasury Agent from in and about the year 1957. At this time, radio drama was well on the way of becoming a shadow of its former self, with the most popular crime drama on the air, Dragnet, seen on television at the same time, was only drawing 3.5 million listeners a week, compared to about 11 million about 5 years before. At the point of this broadcast, Treasury Agent had a couple of million tuned in on Monday evenings at 8. This was also during a revival of the program, first heard a decade before, where there was well over double the amount of crime shows on radio. As television became more ubiquitous in homes, the radio programs that remained on the air strove to keep people listening. So you be the judge with this rare episode of Treasury Agent from 1957 on the Mutual Broadcasting System.
The law enforcement agencies of the United States Treasury constitute the largest group of its kind in the world.
64% of all criminals in federal penitentiaries were apprehended by the 3,000 special agents of the United States Treasury.
Based on actual cases investigated and closed by the United States Treasury Department, the Mutual Broadcasting System, in cooperation with Winston, the easy-drawing filter cigarette that tastes good, like a cigarette should, and ends the tablet that keeps you free of offending odors from head to foot around the clock, presents Treasury Agent.
States Treasury Enforcement Agency.
Secret Service.
Protects our president. Protects our money and securities from counterfeiting.
Intelligence Division.
Jurisdiction over tax frauds and evasion.
Bureau of Customs. Bureau of Narcotics. Alcohol and Tobacco Tax Division.
Coast Guard. Crimes committed on the high seas.
United States Treasury. Largest group of law enforcement agencies in the world. Each week at this same time, Mutual proudly transcribes Treasury Agent, based on the activities of Treasury agents operating here and all over the world. When the facts are all in, it's really very simple. For good mystery, stay tuned to Mutual. Throughout the week, you'll find top-drawer mystery drama of the kind and type you like best. If you prefer stories involving a favorite sleuth, built around his continuing exploits in the field of crime detection, you can hear Broadway Cop, featuring Lou Riley, who's an unofficial aide to the regular police force. Or there's John Steele, adventurer, as a globe-circling wayfarer, Lieutenant Dan Britt, unofficial detective, and David Harding as an ace government counter-spy. For authentic and factual drama, you can listen to top-secret files revealing intrigue on the highest levels, while Squad Room and Crime Fighters each turns the spotlight on the machinery of law at work. And for mystery that's definitely different, Sentenced brings you the story of how modern electronic brains are used in the battle against crime. Those are the facts. For mystery, make it Mutual. Hear them all every week over most of these stations. And now, Treasury Agent and Treasury Agent Joe Lincoln.
I often wonder if the real menace of counterfeiting money is fully understood. We have faith in our money because it's always accepted at face value. But if enough of it is counterfeit, our entire system of currency could be undermined. Therefore, Treasury agents move quickly, even on cases involving relatively small amounts of counterfeit. Let me take you first to a shabby barroom on Chicago's South Side.
Hey, boss.
Yeah.
Look at this.
Yeah?
$20 bill.
No kidding, Murphy. Put it into cash register.
It's phony. It's a counterfeit.
Oh, why don't you give yourself up? Got the whole wall of my office covered with Treasury bulletins about counterfeit dough. And no bill you ever found yet ever turned out to be a phony. Get back behind the bar.
But it's important, Mr. Schmidt. I tell you, it's important. I studied it up in a Treasury pamphlet called Know Your Money, and it's important.
Murphy, I'm not calling the cops for you again. Now get back there behind the bar, Murphy. Or I'll stick my finger in your eye. Go on.
Okay, but someday you're going to be sorry, boss.
Hey, Matt.
Yes?
Give me a blend and plain water.
All right, coming right up. Here you are. That'll be a quarter.
Hey, look, Mac, I haven't got a nickel and change. Can you break this?
It's a 20.
Can you break it?
Well, I'll have to ask the boss if he's got change. Just a second. Boss. Hey, boss.
Yeah?
Well, here's another one, boss. Another 20. And it don't look right to me.
Murphy, what did I tell you?
Mr. Schmidt, look at them bulletins, then look at this bill. It's from the same guy that gave me the first one. The guy unloads two here in half an hour.
Murphy, I said for you to stay behind the bar or I'll stick my finger in your eye.
Please, let me phone the cops, boss. Quick, while the guy is still here.
Ah, if you didn't make such good drinks, I'd fire you, Murphy. All right, go ahead, call.
To Special Agent Joe Lincoln, United States Treasury, Washington. T.T. forwarded from Agent Spencer, District Office, Chicago. Two counterfeit $20 bills located in Southside Tavern. May be part of large counterfeit passing operation. Request your assistance in pursuing investigation further.
Well, here are the bills, Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. Take a look, Al.
Yeah.
Hey, Al. Andrew Jackson is a little cross-eyed.
What?
You see, Spencer? These bills were made by Lustig.
Count Victor Lustig?
Mm-hmm.
We put him in jail years ago.
Yes, Al, and destroyed the plates, but every once in a while, bills made from him show up. They catch the passer.
Well, he got jumpy when the bartender went to the back of the place, but we've got a description of him.
Mm-hmm. Spencer, you reported he came back to that same bar twice inside of half an hour. Odd, isn't it?
We figure he must have been working the bars regularly and forgot he'd been in that one before.
Let's talk to that bartender.
Ah, sure, Mr. Lincoln. Sure, I was leery of him. And Mr. Schmidt wouldn't believe me. But I was right. I was right, wasn't I?
Yes, you certainly were, Murphy. Ever see that man before?
No, but I got a pal across the street. He works for O'Toole's Fish House. They got a bar there, too. He says this guy's been in there.
Since the day he was in here?
Only yesterday, he said. I warned him before, but, he was like Mr. Schmidt. He didn't believe me. But I was right, wasn't I? Hmm?
Yes, Murphy, you were right. We wish every citizen were as alert as you were.
Mr. Lincoln, would you mind repeating that statement to Mr. Schmidt?
I'll do better than that, Murphy. I'll write Mr. Schmidt a letter.
That'll be swell, thanks. I'll have it framed.
O'Toole's Fish House, huh? Maybe we ought to take a look at O'Toole's Fish House, Joe.
Al, you're always hungry.
Oh, not always. Only three times a day.
Yeah, and each time 6 hours long. Okay, let's start with O'Toole's. And if our boy's not at O'Toole's, you'll eat anything they have in a few other places.
Joe, this is the fourth place we've been in. I've eaten fish in O'Toole, Gung Gung Fu Gung at Chin Lo's, apple pie and coffee at Ruggiero's Southside Gardens, family cuisine especially. I can't eat anymore, not for an hour anyway.
Hold it out. Spencer.
Yes?
Brown top coat, scraggly brown mustache, a drooping left eye. Take a look at that boy who just came in.
At the bar?
Mm-hmm.
And paying for a drink with a 20. Take him in for questioning, Joe?
Yeah. You on his right, Spencer, me on his left. Al behind him.
Let's go.
Three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. $10 $20 bills in his wallet. All counterfeit, Joe.
Plus three is spent, Hanson. Do you have any more?
No.
Where'd you get these?
From a guy.
You know, Hanson, there's something beautiful about truth. Ever notice it?
How'd I know they were phony? I'm just as sore as you are.
You look furious.
Do you remember the man who gave you at least $260 in counterfeit 20s?
No, I don't.
Well, do people give you a roll of 20s so often you forget their faces?
I mean, I remember his face all right, but I didn't know him.
A perfect stranger came up to you and said, "Luke, old man, here's a present," and walked away.
Try again, Luke.
I didn't know the guy. He was a bookie. He paid me off.
A bookie where?
In Toledo. I come from Toledo, and he was a bookie I met. I met him, and I put down some dough, and he paid off.
What horse?
Mister, how do I know?
Horse players never forget a horse that paid off.
What horse? What race? What track?
Some guy said, put down some dough on this horse, so I did. It won, and this bookie paid me off. It was in Toledo.
Hanson, you must be very angry at that bookie.
I am. I win $300, and now I got nothing. How do you like that guy, huh?
Where in Toledo did you meet him?
In the hotel lobby there. At the cigar stand.
What hotel?
Let's see now.
The Ohio one? The Statler? The Palace?
The Palace, yeah, that's it.
The Palace Hotel in Toledo?
Yeah.
Hanson, there is no Palace Hotel in Toledo.
Truth is beautiful, Hanson, and it's beautifully true that there is no Palace Hotel in Toledo. Now, where'd you get this money?
Well, I was in Milwaukee.
There's no Palace Hotel in Milwaukee either.
I had a business there. A little store. You know, magazines, novelties, notions, candy. I had a little business there, and I sold it.
For how much?
$850. Cash. And the guy went to the bank and got these 20s and paid me. And I came here to Chicago and put $500 in the bank and started spending the rest. Until I tie down what I'm going to do next.
You know, we can check all this, Hanson.
Can't you leave me alone?
Well, we're going to. In a cell till we check you.
Look, I don't feel so good. Can't you be a nice guy?
Nope. Does that answer your question?
Luke Hanson, alias Gibney, alias Ross, alias Jones, alias Simpson. And here's his picture, Joe.
Mm. From Washington?
Yeah, formerly operated with Count Victor Lustig. Convicted once for passing counterfeit, served a year and a half, released 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Al, listen to this from the chief's letter. We've compared the bills you sent from Chicago with bills made from Lustig's counterfeit plates, and it's clear both sets were made from the same plates, regards and so forth.
Well, this means there's more of that old Lustig money around than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
And now some of his old cronies are busy getting rid of it.
Al, it looks as if I'm going into the market for that counterfeit. I'll go undercover and pass the word around that Joe Morgan is looking for a buy.
Say, yeah, you Joe Morgan?
Yeah.
Have a drink?
You buy him?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, come on, be sociable.
Bourbon.
Murphy, two bourbons. I'm a sociable guy. Guy gets lonely if he isn't sociable. What'd you say your name was?
I didn't. You did.
Oh, yeah. Joe Morgan. My name's Mort Barker.
How are you, Mort?
How are you? Yeah, when a guy gets lonely, usually has a reason. Like, not having any dough.
Oh. Who hasn't got any dough?
I know lots of guys without dough. But I do know one guy with dough.
Oh. You know, I always like to meet a guy with dough.
Well, he's a very sociable guy. And this particular guy, he likes to meet other guys with dough.
Yeah. Let me buy you a drink next, huh?
You got dough?
I want more.
Maybe I am. Maybe I ought to bring you and this other guy together. Two sociable guys with dough. Then I could say to you, I want a cut, a little squeeze, a little sort of something to make up for my trouble. I could say that, couldn't I, without anybody getting sore?
Well, why should I get sore, Mort? Your sociable friend is the one to pay you.
All I want is that you know I'm the guy that brings you two sociable fellas together.
I want to see a sample.
No deal without?
No deal without.
You living in a hotel or where?
The Redstone, Randolph Street.
I'll have to go to Milwaukee for the sample, but I'll call you as soon as I get back. Okay, now let's just be sociable.
she is, Joe.
Pretty, ain't it?
Well, a $100 bill is always pretty. You interested?
Oh, what good is one to me? I need more.
My sociable friend's got 133 more bills like this one.
All hundreds, Morty? Nothing smaller?
No, not anymore. Hmm.
133 $100 bills comes to $13,300. How much you want?
My sociable friend says $5,000.
Here's your sample, Mort. So long.
Oh, now look, Joe.
Three notes are hard to get rid of again. But $3,000 is plenty.
Joe, give us a break. Make it $4,000. Hey, what are you doing?
Writing down the serial number of your sample bill.
What's the gag?
Well, the rest of the bills have following serial numbers, don't they? I want to make sure I get the right batch. Now what happens?
I got to go back to Milwaukee, see my sociable friend, and close the deal.
Mort, I could save you all this traveling.
Yeah?
Yeah, I could meet you in Milwaukee, say, the Green Hotel.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be swell.
All right, I'll meet you there in 2 days, say, and we'll close up. Oh, and Mort.
Yeah.
This works out, I can use the same amount from you every month.
I'll find out, Joe. So long.
Right. Al?
I got it all through the connecting door, Joe.
Good. Now, this afternoon, we'll fix 4,000 of marked bills. And then tonight, Milwaukee and the Green Hotel.
Here you are, Joe.
Thanks. Hello?
Lincoln, Spencer.
Oh, how you doing, Spencer?
I've been on Barker's tail ever since he got off the train.
Mm-hmm.
He finally met a man an hour or so ago at a house on Fielding Avenue. Then they came out and got into this other man's car and drove to a bar. That's where I am now. They're sitting in a corner arguing.
That doesn't sound good, does it?
Well, I can't hear what they're saying. Can't get close enough.
Mm-hmm. Where's the bar, Spencer?
Around the corner from your hotel. Washington Street.
All right, meet us outside there in about a minute.
Lincoln?
Oh, Spencer.
They still in there?
And still arguing.
Now, we've got to find out if what they're selling me is the last of the Lustig money. Now, Spencer, which is the other man's car?
That black coupe standing by itself.
All right. I'll try the rear baggage compartment now.
Right. It's locked.
Try our master key.
Have it already.
What's the deal, Lincoln?
I'll have to take a ride in the baggage compartment.
Hey, that's dangerous. That other fellow looks tough.
Well, I told Mort Barker I wanted more counterfeit money every month just to draw them out, you know. Now, this is the only chance we've got now of finding out if they've got the last of the Lustig money or if there's more. How you doing now?
Here she comes. Ah, good. Nice roomy one. I better get in, Joe.
How is it, Al?
Oh, boy. Smells of gas and oil in here.
Otherwise?
Only a thin sheet of metal between me and the inside of the car. I'll be able to hear. Just have to take a chance he doesn't lock the compartment later.
Right. We'll tail you in Spencer's car.
Close the top.
Right.
Good luck, Al.
Thanks.
Get in the car, Mort. We'll go back to my joint. I got some beer in the refrigerator.
Swell.
Ah, the battery's dying on me. I hope it starts.
Look, Ed, Joe Morgan wants the stuff delivered to him personally. Now, that ain't much to ask.
But he won't pay any more than $4,000.
Well, $4,000 is good. I pretty near lost the whole deal. He wants lots more of our dough.
This is all we got, Mort. It's the last of Victor Lustig's dough. So what do we do then?
I call him at the Green Hotel. We go there and deliver it.
Tomorrow night, huh?
Yeah.
Well, let's go home and have a few beers.
Good idea.
Okay, Mort. Out.
Yep. Hey, you left the engine running, huh?
Yeah. I gotta recharge the battery.
Well, you better lock the garage door. Somebody will steal his crate.
Yeah.
Just a second.
Hey, the baggage compartment ain't locked.
No?
Hey, that's funny.
So lock it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on. Let's go.
How long did you want to wait here?
Oh, we've got to give Al time to come out of the garage. Hey, wait a minute.
What?
Maybe he can't.
We better look, hadn't we?
The only light I see in the house is in back. The kitchen, I guess it is. All right, let's go. Huh? Well, bring that jacket, okay? Hold it. The engine's still running in there.
Yeah. Easy, Lincoln. They'll hear us.
Al's in there. Must have been locked in. Come on, let's have that jacket.
Yep.
Push the door, Spencer.
Right.
Easy now. Easy.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Oh, smell that exhaust.
Right, let's get the compartment open.
Okay. Jack handle again.
Yep. It's okay, Al. Put away the gun.
Oh, Joe. Joe, it is the last of the Victor Lustig counterfeit. I'm pretty near the last to me.
Yeah, I know. Spencer, you fix up the car in the garage so they won't know anything happened. Then come to the hotel. Al needs a doctor. Hello?
Joe?
Yeah?
Mort Barker. 9:30 tonight, okay? It's your room, the hotel?
Yeah, 9:30's fine. Room 601.
See you then.
Al, 9:30 tonight. You okay?
Oh, good enough.
Good. Now, Spencer, you and Al stay in the room across the hall. After we make the deal and transfer the money, I'll maneuver Mort Barker and the other man out into the corridor. Now, I'll light a cigarette, and then I'll drop my room key. That's the signal. Now, don't forget. Then both of you pop out, and we grab them with the marked money on them. Okay, Mort. Counts out okay, $13,300.
Yeah. And Ed?
Yeah, Mort.
His $4,000 checks out okay, too.
Swell. Let's go.
Ed, I kind of like my friend Mort Barker here. I'd like to be sure he gets his cut.
What do you care?
I'd just soon have it now as later, Ed.
Okay.
How much is 12% of $4,000?
$480.
Mm-hmm.
20. 40, 60. Here you are, Mort. 480.
Thanks. Well, Joe, so long.
Mort, you always said Ed was a sociable guy. How about the three of us having a sociable drink downstairs, huh?
Hey, let's do that, Ed.
I don't mind if I do. Yeah, but Mort, don't you let me get a snootful like last night, huh?
Last night?
I got a snootful, that's all.
Oh. Oh, we don't have to be that sociable. just a second. I locked my door. Yeah. Cigarette, Mort?
Yeah, thanks.
Ed?
No. I want a drink.
Light, Mort?
Ooh. Come on, will you?
Well, I've got to light my cigarette. Can't do it walking, you know. Oh, here, drop my key.
I get it. There it is.
Oh, thanks. I just let me get the cigarette lit. Oh, of course, my key.
Are you nervous, Joe?
Oh, me? You got a match, Mort?
You guys take a week to light a butt.
All right, take it easy, Ed. We're in no hurry.
I don't like to hang around places. Not now. Come on, let's go. Joe, what are you stalling for?
I'm only lighting a cigarette.
You're stalling so some of the buddies of yours can hijack us?
What?
Not a chance, Joe. You...
Ed, you got this all wrong.
Lock him, you jerk. Let's beat it.
Okay, cut it out, you jerk.
I told you, Mort. All right, both of your hands high.
Joe, you all right? What is this, a hijack?
United States Treasury.
Treasury. Mort, you're lucky.
All right, Spencer. In Ed's coat pocket, the marked money I paid him.
Mort, why you...
And in Mort Barker's wallet, $480, also marked. Here's the counterfeit I bought.
Joe, you double-crossing... I thought you were a sociable guy.
Al, what delayed you boys in getting the signal?
Oh, my fault. I suddenly got dizzy from those fumes again.
Yeah, I know. It's rough work, Al. My jaw hurts a little, too. All right, come on, you two sociable characters. You're going where you can be sociable for a long time.
Special Agent Joe Lincoln.
After that investigation, which almost cost the life of Special Agent Al Williams, we were able to report that the last of a once very dangerous store of counterfeit money had been found and would be destroyed. As you've seen, the case began with the help of an alert citizen. You can help, too, by reporting any suspicious-looking currency to your nearest police station or treasury office.
Next week, another treasury agent case. Locale?
New York, Saratoga Springs, Hollywood, and a certain patio near a fountain.
Under investigation?
The fraudulently small return to the government by an entertainment entrepreneur abetted by conjugal stratagems.
That was one of the few surviving episodes of Treasury Agent, a Mutual Radio broadcast from 1957. This is an hour of Collection Curios on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark Livonier. Next, a program that is hard to fit into a certain genre, but it's an interesting find from our collection of reel-to-reel tapes, and that's an episode of Stroke of Fate from NBC, a program that imagined if a person or a moment from history took a different turn and really played out the what-if scenario for only 2.5 months on NBC, Sunday nights at 9. The program only produced 13 shows, but all of them have been preserved, and here's the second one from October 11th, 1953.
The fate of individuals, of nations, of the world is often hung upon accident or upon decisions that, made the other way, would have substantially altered the course of human events. Suppose fate had decreed that Leonardo da Vinci, who tried to invent a flying machine in the 15th century, had actually succeeded. Would we now be flying to the moon? Suppose by a stroke of fate Napoleon had won at Waterloo. Would we now have a United States of Europe? Yes, much depends upon a stroke of fate. And tonight we rewrite history as we present a dramatic conception of what might have happened
if by a stroke of fate the plot of the Earl of Essex to depose Queen Elizabeth I had succeeded.
Our story is historically true up to a certain point. The rest is imagination. The Earl of Essex, Queen Elizabeth I's favorite, plotted a number of times against his sovereign and her chief advisors. On February 25th, 1601, Essex was executed for high treason. If, however, one of his plots had succeeded, he very probably would have sent his bitter enemy, Sir Walter Raleigh, to England's grim jail for state prisoners, the Tower of London. Had this happened, it is possible that Walter Raleigh, a prolific writer, might have written an account of the Essex conspiracy. This is his account.
Waiting here in the Tower of London, in this year 1601, for what will no doubt be my doom, I, Walter Raleigh, have resolved to set down the tragic story of the Earl of Essex and of Her Majesty Elizabeth, whom I will forever look on as my queen. I well remember the first coming to court of Robert Devereux, the Earl of Essex, and the Queen's own first cousin, twice removed. He was fortune's child, tall and with a manly beauty, and the Queen loved such men. The Lord of Essex was in his 21st year. The Queen was 53.
And so, young cousin, welcome to our court. Indeed, you were a child when last we saw you.
It has ever been my dearest wish to be near your majesty. And now that I have seen my sovereign again, I say that memory lies when it recalls her beauty.
What is this, sir?
I say memory lies, for it does not do justice to the radiance of her presence, the grace of her bearing, the incomparable loveliness of her face.
So young, and yet already so much the courtier.
If your majesty doubts either my words or my devotion...
And so spirited... But enough of this. Tonight we dance and play at cards. Tomorrow we hunt. It is our pleasure, my Lord Essex, that you join us.
The Earl of Essex, I admit, quickly did supplant me in the Queen's affections. In short order, he became Master of the Horse, Knight of the Garter, and in 1593, a Councillor of State. In company with Sir Robert Cecil, her Associate Secretary of the Council, I sought to warn Her Majesty about Essex.
You may speak your mind if you will, Sir Walter.
Please, Your Majesty, it grieves me much to speak so against any man, and especially one so dear...
Now, no long preambles, if you will. Please, please, to the point.
It is to advise you that Milord of Essex is...
Yes?
He is dangerous, Your Majesty. Under pretense of affection for you, he grasps for power. He spreads his spies throughout the court.
Is this what you wish to say to us?
Robert Cecil will support me in this.
I have already spoken of this to our gracious sovereign.
And they say we women are jealous. Enough. Enough, I say. Be gone and let us hear no more.
Indeed, Her Majesty was enamored of Essex, yet not completely deceived by him. In the year 1593, the office of Attorney General became vacant, and Essex sought this position for his friend Francis Bacon, against whom Her Majesty had set her heart.
If you love me, as you say, you'd grant this small request of mine.
But, Essex, it was Master Bacon who stopped the passage of the tax bill we need to carry on the war against Spain.
And I say the attorneyship for Francis is what I must have. And in that I will spend all my power, might, and authority to procure it for him.
This power... This authority, as you call it, you forget we have given it to you. We can as easily remove it.
But then, Your Majesty, permit me to remove myself from court.
We have not given you leave to go. Ah, Essex, why must we quarrel? I do not wish to quarrel with you.
Nor I with you. But I have promised that I would procure this position for Francis.
Then you must undo your promise. He is not fitted for the office, as is Edward Coke.
And who has put forth Edward Coke? Robert Cecil and Raleigh, my enemies of your ear. You grant favors to my enemies and you deny them to me.
I deny you favors. I, who have given you honors beyond count and over £100,000 in money to pay your mountain of debt. I have given, given, given. Besides, I have not yet decided on Edward Coke.
And Francis is my friend.
Yes, he is your friend, and that's a rub. Your stepfather, the Earl of Leicester, had so many of his friends about us, we found it hard to withstand him. If we have any more of your friends as advisors, through them you will rule us, and we will become a puppet queen. And we will not become a puppet queen.
Her Majesty waited a suitable time and then did appoint Edward Coke, Attorney General. My Lord of Essex retired from court in anger. There was a reconciliation, more quarrels, more reconciliations, still more quarrels. Yet Essex remained the highest in Her Majesty's affections. In July of 1598, the Irish rose under the chieftainship of the rebel Earl of Tyrone, and Her Majesty was in the council chamber with Essex, the Secretary of the Council, Robert Cecil, and others. She'd been trying to decide on the appointment of the Lord Deputy to put down the Irish rebellion, and that talk had become angry.
There! We have decided upon it.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Sir William Knollys will be our Lord Deputy to Ireland.
I shall not permit you to make that mistake.
We do not ask permission of anyone, my Lord of Essex. Be ruled. Sir William Knollys it shall be.
Oh.
You turn your back on us.
This is an outrage. I will not put up with being struck by anyone. I would not have borne it from your father, King Henry.
You dare draw your sword. Be gone and be hanged.
There were those who thought Her Majesty would have Essex sent to the Tower to be imprisoned or executed. But she did not. Essex retired to his house at Wanstead. And at court, Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth...
This Essex, whom we have raised from nothing, says he cannot ask for pardon. But, Cecil, we will yet break his pride.
Your Majesty, before his disgrace, the Earl grew daily in popular favor. He was such a favorite with the people that his popularity even began to...
Say it, Cecil. Rival ours? Never.
But would it not be wise, now that he's been brought low, to...
Execute him?
Imprison him.
What manner of advice is this, Cecil? The people think more of him now than they did before. They believe he has been badly used. Imprison him, they will hate us for it.
I bow to your majesty's wisdom. Yet I cannot fathom the reason for his lordship's popularity.
He is handsome. He is courageous. He is generous. And for the good that is in him, we will yet tame this thoroughbred.
The woeful misfortunes of our army in Ireland, defeated by the rebel Tyrone, provided the occasion for the reconciliation. Essex offered his services to the Queen, and she did accept them. But when in council there was discussion as to who would lead our forces against Tyrone, it was shown that the thoroughbred was still untamed.
We truly think that Lord Mountjoy should command.
I do oppose that, Your Majesty.
But why, my Lord of Essex? Mountjoy is an able man.
Mountjoy is my friend.
And you wish your friends to remain at court, my Lord?
It is not that, Your Majesty. But Mountjoy is a scholar rather than a general.
And my Lord of Essex,
what man do you think should be appointed to put down Tyrone?
And I would say that the man sent into Ireland should be some prime man of the nobility, who is strong in power, honor, and wealth, in favor with military men, and who has before been general of an army.
My Lord, you seem to point the finger at yourself.
Well, we do not think the Earl of Essex means himself.
Why not? Does your majesty not think I am capable of putting down this puny rebellion? Yes. I urge my claim to be commander of this army.
Very well. But you must attack Tyrone immediately. We will accept no excuse for failure.
When my Lord of Essex came to Ireland, instead of immediately attacking the rebel Tyrone in Ulster, against the Queen's advice, he spent 4 months in useless expeditions elsewhere. With dead, wounded, and desertions, his army of 16,000 had become but 4,000. Her Majesty wrote him letter after letter demanding action against Tyrone. One day, this hothead, angered at news he had received, madly confided in his two close friends and subordinates, Sir Christopher Blunt and the Earl of Southampton. It was in Dublin.
My Lord Southampton, I tell you I have just learned that the Queen has made Robert Cecil Master of the Wards. A position she denied me when I asked for it. Cecil. She rewards my enemies who wish us ill success in this mission. And she herself wishes us ill.
I am sorry to hear it, my lord.
My patience is at an end. No longer can I wait here idly while Cecil and Raleigh plot my disgrace and my death. I propose to lead my army to Wales, where there are thousands who will follow me. And then to London.
But the Lord of Essex, what if Wales does not rise at your bidding?
And even if it does, the Queen is certain to resist you strongly. It means civil war.
But I must return home and face those who hate me before I'm ruined by them.
My Lord, why not return to England with 300 competent men at your side? They are not enough to arouse suspicion, but if the Queen should try to imprison you, or worse, they would be able to effect a rescue. It will then be time enough to think of rousing the country.
I will consider that.
And so Essex sent to the rebel Tyrone and did make a truce with him, which was far from what the Queen desired, for she had written to Essex of Tyrone.
To trust this traitor upon oath is to trust the devil upon his religion.
The truce concluded, my Lord Essex, with his 300 competent men, crossed to England. Her Majesty at first had received him kindly, but when she discovered that Essex had but few soldiers with him, she had him brought before a tribunal, where the Earl confessed to many misdemeanors. But the Queen was merciful. However, Essex, still thinking the Queen meant to do him evil, plotted against her and her counselors. On Michaelmas, in the year 1600... the Queen deprived the Earl of one of his main sources of revenue, the right to collect duties on the importing of sweet wines. And furious, he said,
"The Queen, now that she is an old woman, is no less crooked and distorted in her mind than she is in body."
And now, believing that the Queen surely meant to ruin him, Essex and his fellow plotters felt it was time to act swiftly. And some of them met at Drury House, where lived the Earl of Southampton, Essex staying away to avoid suspicion.
Well, I heard only... My lords, gentlemen,
We can wait no longer. It is now certain that Cecil has persuaded the Queen to imprison and execute the Earl of Essex.
My Lord Southampton, our soldiers from Ireland are in London. We can count on them rising against the council.
We must rouse the people of London for the Earl. That is all planned and by the Earl. There are hundreds of his supporters throughout the city awaiting a sign. But first, we must take possession of the court. And of the Queen.
Huh? Of Her Majesty?
Yes, it is the only way.
Once we have the Queen, London is bound to be ours.
Yes, and the rest of England with it. At a signal, you and your parties will step between the guards and their weapons and take possession of the court. Then the Earl of Essex will come to Her Majesty and present his demands that she make the changes in the government we all desire and place him back in power.
And if the Queen refuses?
She will not. Now this the Earl does urge. If possible, let there be no bloodshed.
If drawing blood means the difference between success and failure, rather than go to the block, I will draw blood even from herself. My lord, what treason is this?
It is not treason, Your Majesty. We are your loyal subjects.
Loyal subjects? And you dare to enter our presence with drawn swords?
No one has... Put up your swords, gentlemen.
The Lord of Essex, have you come here to murder us?
No, Your Majesty. To protect you.
To protect, in heaven's name, against what? What protection do we need?
Protection, Your Majesty, against evil counselors who are the true enemies of yourself. And of England.
The only evil counselor we ever had, Essex, was you. Guard! Help! Guard!
Your shouts will be of no avail, Your Majesty. The court is in our hands.
Madmen! Do you know the penalty for treason? Have you never heard the screams of traitors drawn and quartered, suffering such agonies as hell itself would envy?
We knew what we did risk.
How long do you think you can hold the court? London will rise for us.
You are our hostage against that.
You would dare harm us?
We are sure that will not be necessary. And for the love I bear you.
Love? Don't befoul the word by using it. What a fool I was, Essex.
Your Majesty.
And now we who have not bowed to kings have been brought to this by you.
Your Majesty.
So you wish us to dismiss our ministers?
That will not be needed, Your Majesty. Cecil and the others who are not for us are already on their way to the tower. And we have taken the tower.
That insolence will be punished. All of you will suffer. Unless you return to your homes and let us think on whether we shall grant you mercy.
We know it is too late for that, Your Majesty. All I ask of you is that henceforth you be advised by me.
You would be the king without a crown, and we your creature. We would rather die.
Let us not speak of dying, Your Majesty. Believe me, our plans do not lie in that direction.
Then what would you do if we will not be advised by you? Depose us?
I trust it will not come to that.
England will rise for us, not for you. Did you truly think we would be your puppets? Well, what are you going to do? Send us to the tower?
You leave me no choice. Your Majesty?
Have you come here, Essex, to release your rightful sovereign? To pay obeisance to us? To beg for mercy?
I have come here to ask...
forgiveness? To crawl before us? Lord Mountjoy has whipped your traitorous followers. You have fled the field, and Mountjoy, at the head of our loyal armies, will soon be in London.
I have not as yet met Mountjoy in the field. I meet him tomorrow. Nor do I think that I will be beaten.
Then why are you here, Essex? Is it to tell us that in 2 days we are to die? But why talk of dying? When tomorrow Mountjoy will whip you, we will be free, and then there will be a bloodletting.
Your Majesty, I have come to ask a favor of you.
You are pale, Essex. You tremble. Does your conscience bother you that you have let loose in England bloody civil war?
It is to stop such killing that I come to you. If you will make me your chief minister, I will release you. And with your position once restored,
There'll be no need of fighting.
Our position would not be restored if we must dance to your tune. And you know we would not dance to it long. Shall we tell you why you have come here?
To make you an offer of freedom.
So you say. But you know we would not take freedom on such terms. No. You have decided we must die or play your game, and you know we will not play it. Yet, to kill a queen is a great thing. And you, little man, draw back from doing it.
There will be bloody war as long as you're hostage, and there is hope of rescuing you.
Or as long as we are alive. Why not say that, too? But if you kill us, there will still be war. Those who love us will not love you for sending us to death.
One cannot always rule by love.
One can no longer rule England by fear. And do you not think, once we are dead, every nation in Europe will come down upon you? Do you not know every king will fear that as long as you succeed, he too may be deposed by a subject?
You are not deposed.
Death is a great deposer of monarchs. And death is what you wish for us.
I wish you to be free.
Then free us. But we will make no terms. And no promises.
I would that it were otherwise.
Hypocrite. At least have courage enough to see yourself as you really are. We could admire a brave villain, but a cowardly one, never.
I, a coward?
And worse. You did plot against us again and again. We knew it. And yet we did forgive you for the love we bore you and for the love you said you bore us.
I did love you once.
Liar. Liar. Your only love has been for power. You hunger for power as other men hunger for bread. And to gain it, you will do a deed so black, no Englishman will ever say the name of Essex without feeling shame that Essex, too, was an Englishman.
I go now to fight your Lord Mountjoy. If he wins, I will die on the field, and you are free.
If you win, we die on Tower Green, where died our mother Anne Boleyn. But if Mountjoy wins, and you die not on the field, you will go to the block.
Farewell.
Farewell? No compliments about my beauty, my loveliness. Then I see indeed I am no longer your queen.
Was beheaded on Tower Green, Queen Elizabeth. You have just heard the second episode in a new series, Stroke of Fate, in which we show how fateful decisions and accidents might have changed history. Now it is our pleasure to present our historical consultant on tonight's story, noted author of the books The Presidency, The New World, Lincoln, A Picture Story of His Life, and writer of a drama about Elizabeth and Essex, Stephen Laurent.
As we all know, in reality, it was not Queen Elizabeth who was executed, but Essex. Now, let's speculate. If Essex had succeeded in his plot, how might that have changed history? He would have probably become the ruler of England, and James, King of Scotland, would have never followed Elizabeth on the throne. Essex was a hothead, an aggressive man. He would have probably attacked Spain, and since England needed gold, he would have tried to take from Philip III the Spanish possessions in the New World. If he had won, South America might have become English territory instead of Spanish. No English settlers would have come to the northern part of our continent, no pilgrims, no Puritans. And so there might be no United States today. Come to think of it, it is just as well that Essex was beheaded.
Thank you, Mr. Laurent. Won't you join us again next week on Stroke of Fate to hear what might have happened if
Alexander Hamilton had killed Aaron Burr in their famous duel.
In tonight's Stroke of Fate presentation, one of the theater's most distinguished actresses, Judith Evelyn, starred as Elizabeth. Featured were Carl Swenson as Essex, Alexander Scourby as Raleigh,
Others in the cast, Horace Braham, Ian Martin, Ted Osborne, and Bedford Hampton. Lionel Rico speaking. Stroke of Fate is produced by Morton Lester Lewis, conceived and written by Mort Lewis. Directed by Fred Way. This is the NBC Radio Network.
Stroke of Fate, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 11th of October, 1953 on NBC. And that's it for this hour of underheard and unique shows from the past, and I hope you can be with us again for more collection curios from radio's golden era on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for listening.